All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I was a CW-2 helicopter type pilot in Vietnam 1969. Welcome home to all of our troops everywhere. Hopefully we can get all of you home at some point in the future. We've got an interesting program today, I think. It was about 100 years ago that World War I began on April 6, 1917. And so that's what we're going to be talking about. There's a centennial commission that's out there, and we're going to that's going to be talking about all kinds of things about World War I, some of the people that participated in it, their ceremonies, their educational purposes, all kinds of projects that are going to be going on over the next 100, I don't know, probably next 2 years at least, or a year. And we're going to be talking to some of those folks. We're also going to have another guest on the program. He's going to be talking about World War I and how we got involved in World War I and the results of it. And, you know, World War I was the war to end all wars. Well, not quite. And so I think we're going to find out a lot of interesting things today. When we come back, we're going to be talking with two of the commissioners from the, World War I Centennial Commission. And it says, you know, what we've got here is got World War I remains America's forgotten war. I was talking with our assistant earlier before the program, and she says, you know, I got a feeling that there are people a little bit younger than I am that don't know anything about World War I. So I think this is what the commission's job is going to do, is to let America know what happened during this time period over there in France with the Doughboys and so forth. So I'm really excited to get with our guests. We're going to have, as I mentioned, two members of the commission. We'll be on when we come back. I want to remind you that if you want to participate in the program, you can give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. Or you can call us toll-free at 844-838-1600. That's 844-838-1600. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook. You can follow us on the web at veteransradio.net and listen live, of course. And as I said, you can follow on Facebook and Twitter. We have podcasts up there. And we've got our archives, of course, which we've got now 13 years of programming pretty much on our archives. And the last thing, of course, is our bookstore, where whenever we have an author on a program, we always put their bookstores up, or their book covers up onto our bookstore and give you a link to where you can purchase the book if you are interested. So we're going to take a real quick break just for a little news and an announcement, and then we'll be right back with members of the World War I Centennial Commission.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there. It's a long way.
And we are back on Veterans Radio with some of that fine music from 1917 or 18. We are welcoming two board members right now. We're trying to get a hold of our second one. But right now, joining me on the line is Dr. Libby O'Connell. And Dr. O'Connell is a member of the Historical Advisory Board of the World War I Centennial Commission. She is also, this is a pretty interesting woman. I can't wait to talk to her. She is Chief Historian, Senior Vice President, Corporate Outreach of the American Entertainment. Looks like serves as Historical Advisor for History Programming Department. In addition, to spearhead all educational community-based initiatives. Whew. Histories take a veteran to school and all kinds of things. Wow. So, Dr. O'Connell, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. It's nice to be here.
That's a very impressive biography you've got going there.
Well, I was the chief historian at the History Channel and worked at A&E for many, many years.
Oh, I wish
I'm actually emeritus now, and I do consulting for them.
Oh, okay. Well, we know
That's just an update.
We know a nice Veterans Radio show that they should be looking at somewhere down the line. We haven't been able to get a hold of our other guest, Dr. Seyfried, so I'm going to be talking to you initially.
Okay, that's fine.
We'll keep trying to get a hold of her.
She's very busy, and I'm sure she wants to be here, so. But I'm happy to start with you.
Okay. So we know, that, as I mentioned earlier on, that the coming up on April 6th is the 100th anniversary of the beginning of America's involvement in World War One. Can you tell me a little bit about this commission and what are their goals and aspirations?
Sure. First of all, remember that World War One began in Europe in 1914, so it had already been raging
right.
for its first 2.5 years before America got involved. But the commission was stood up in the end of 2013, and little by little it was established with different. Some people were appointed by the president, some people were appointed by Congress and the Senate. We have representation from the VFW, and the other veterans groups on the commission. So we have two goals. Well, the three premise of the commission is to honor, to educate, and to commemorate. Right? Mm-hmm. So we are involved in educating the public, and when we talk about education, we're not just talking about schools. We mean adults and anyone out there who most people don't know much about World War One, if they know anything at all.
Right.
So we have a big task ahead of us. And also, you know, this is a war where more men lost their lives than in Korea and Vietnam combined. There were 4 million enlisted. 2 million went overseas. So it's a shame that there's no national memorial for them in Washington, D.C. So one of the goals of the commission is to create a memorial for those soldiers who gave their lives and the ones who served. So it's for sacrifice not only of their people who lost their lives, but for the people who went knowing that they might sacrifice their lives. And that's underway. You can go to our website and learn more about how we are raising funds and the designs that we are deciding on. And it's a big, big task ahead of us.
The reason I got interested in this whole idea is that I belong to the VFW here locally in Ann Arbor, and their magazine this month is totally dedicated to World War One, and they've got one of the main memorials to World War One is in Kansas City.
That's right.
And I wasn't aware of that, so now I have to take a drive out to Kansas City to see this one.
Not only is there a wonderful memorial there, but there is a world-class museum on World War One. It's the National World War One Museum, and I recommend it to anyone. It's worth the trip, and Kansas City is a lovely city by itself, but that museum is top-notch, and they're a partner of the commission's in our educational outreach. And that's one way the commission has been able to be effective is because we have partners like the National World War One Museum. We're ex officio partners with the big cultural institutions like Smithsonian. The Library of Congress has a new exhibit that's going to be a blockbuster. Smithsonian has some great exhibits at the Museum of American History and in aerospace. And other museums around the country. There's a big one in Albany. I know because I'm from New York. I'm very familiar with what's going on in New York State. Mm-hmm. And that's key, too. We have set up and put out a call for each state to form their own commission. And about 40 states are now participating with their own statewide commission. So there are things going on in all over the country, and it's very exciting.
I certainly agree with you. We are talking with Dr. Libby O'Connell, who is a member of the commission for the United States World War One Centennial Commission. And what they're trying to do is raise awareness of World War One, of course, and to build a national memorial on the Mall in Washington, D.C. There are some memorials around the country. The biggest that I'm aware of right now is in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. But I think that this is World War One is kind of fascinating to me. I didn't even think about it that much because my father was just at the age where he missed that. He got to do World War II instead, but that's a different story.
Well, it's actually part of the same story, and I think in 100 years, people will look back on it the way we look back on the, you know, the 30-year war. They'll mm-hmm. see it as World War One was, you know, sort of volume one of the two books of the great conflict of, you know, World War One, World War Two, because it feeds in so directly as a cause of World War II. So many of the issues were not resolved or not resolved well. And as you mentioned in the introduction, originally the so-called Great War was going to be the war that ended all wars, right?
Right. Yeah.
But what did it do? It actually ended peace. It was the peace that ended all peace for the 20th century. And we're still looking at the hot spots around the country that were influence and really the origins of those hotspots were set up by the terms of the peace of World War One. It's the areas in the Middle East, the Ukraine, Ireland now is a very peaceful and productive part of an independent country in the Northern Ireland part of the UK, but it wasn't that long ago when there was pretty a lot of local, you know, violence there, and that was part of the outcomes of World War One. So we are still seeing the impact of the Versailles Treaty today.
I just think it's fascinating how this, I mean, you know, we're going to learn more about this as we go on, I'm sure. But, you know, how it began mm-hmm. and, you know, all of the agreements and alliances mm-hmm. and so forth that were out there. And
right.
as a result of this assassination of the
Archduke Ferdinand, yeah.
That everybody kind of fell into place.
Yes, it was. There's a book out called Sleepwalkers, and you do get this sense that, oh, well, we promised we'd help the Russians, and the Russians are mobilizing, so we better join in. And nobody stopped to think, is that really the right thing to do? Should we go forward with, you know, with our pledges? You want to maintain your treaties. Treaties are not to be ignored casually, but when that means that all the European powers are facing off in the battlefield for a terribly destructive war. It's an interesting war, though. I hate to say interesting about war.
Yeah, you know, war but you're a historian,
mm-hmm.
so
yeah,
this is interesting.
Things that happened, you know, history is change over time, okay? History is change over time, but war accelerates change. And some of that change is good, and some of that change is bad. But one of the things that you do see in almost every war is a change in medical developments. Mm-hmm. And World War One is a time when they started using blood transfusions in the field. They start doing different ways of setting broken limbs so that people survive them. We don't think of a broken femur as a cause of death today, but back in the 19th century, people died. Most people who broke their thigh bone would die, mm-hmm. and it was only during World War One that they figured out how to set that in the field situation where people could survive. But there are other, and there, of course, a tank is first introduced.
Right.
And one of my favorite little anecdotes about World War One is why we call the tank a tank.
And why is that?
You know why? Because the British were developing a tank, and they wanted to keep it top secret. And they had these big, sort of not quite rectangular things made out of metal, large, mm-hmm. out in a field, and they wanted to hide them. So they were building water tanks.
Oh. Huh.
So that's why we call it a tank.
It's sort of what they look like, too.
Yeah, sort of what they look like. And, you know, today people still wear those beautiful watches by Cartier, which are known as tank watches, because the strap has that caterpillar effect around your wrist.
Okay.
Still a popular watch. It was named after they were developed in World War One, named after a tank. And that's when men started wearing wrist watches. They were sort of considered ladies' jewelry before that. Mm-hmm. Men wore pocket watches. Those were serious,
yes.
Right?
We all have our grandfather's pocket watch.
Mm-hmm. But if you're in battle, or you're, you know, setting up ordnance and you need to have it timed, you need something that you can just quickly glance at and not use your other hand. And that's when men started wearing wristwatches. So that's a very small little innovation, but nobody thinks of wristwatches as being, you know, a lady's piece of jewelry today. Doesn't matter who you are. Lots of people wear wristwatches.
That's true. Or no, not anymore, because you look at your phone.
You look at your phone, right? I still wear a watch.
We're talking with Dr. Libby O'Connell from the United States World War I Centennial Commission, and we want to find out a little bit about what's going on. You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that you were going to be setting up educational programs around the country. What type are you looking at? You mentioned beyond schools.
Well, first of all, there are some wonderful documentaries coming up on television, which I really recommend. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great introduction for all Americans on PBS. It begins on April 10th. That'll be a Monday night. And there'll be three nights, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And they're going to be doing a 6 hours in total, but 2 hours every night on what they call the Great War. Mm-hmm. And it really focuses on America's involvement. It's not going to be lengthy, in-depth study of the European powers, although they'll be explained. So I think it's going to be a great show, and I recommend that to everyone. I also know that a lot of archives and libraries are in different states all over the country are having their own local exhibits. Mm-hmm. World War I affected everyone in this country. And, you know, many of the monuments in local towns have the names of men and women who fell in World War II, but on the reverse side, they're the people who died for the country from World War I. There are lots of little local memorials, and we are encouraging everyone to restore those memorials if they need a little TLC.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the commission has a grant system for 100 memorials. We will help 100 cities to restore their memorials. And you can find out more about that on our website. Yeah. We have a newsletter that's going out to teachers. It's free. It's in partnership with the National World War I Museum, and it's top-notch. We have lots of terrific organizations contributing, like the National Archives, National History Day, the History Channel, of which I'm particularly proud.
I'm sure.
And I really recommend that, and it's for designed for teachers, but certainly anyone will learn from these, and that's the link for that is on our website in the education column as well. So we are doing lots of outreach, and I have to say that the VFW magazine on the World War I is fabulous. Your organization should be so proud.
It's just got so much great information in here, and I don't think it's up online yet, but it probably will be in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, probably by April 6th.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
Time
Magazine has an issue on World War I, and USA Today has published a supplement. So we're going to see, and people out there who are your listeners are going to sort of start encountering the centennial now.
Mm-hmm.
We've been working on it for a couple of years. Now's the time you're going to see the fruit of our work, and we'll be working on it for the next year and a half. And Armistice is, of course, the 100th anniversary of Armistice, which is when Veterans Day is held, is November 11th, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 2018, and that will be a big, big anniversary that we hope everyone observes and understands and sort of increases. You are Veterans Radio. You're reaching veterans. But we want all Americans to understand that veterans throughout our history have been willing to sacrifice their life for what they believe in.
I'm just thinking that just recently that a local town, Chelsea, Michigan, celebrated their World War I veterans. Mm-hmm. And they had a huge, big, giant pictures of many of the of their veterans on the side of their buildings in town.
Isn't that wonderful?
And it was fascinating because so many of the names, of course, are still out there. I mean,
yeah.
You know, their families have lived in these little towns forever.
Yeah.
And you recognize the names, and you go, "Wow!" You know, you don't even think about unfortunately, we don't think about World War I enough because World War II and everything else that came after it.
Right.
But I think going back to what you mentioned earlier on is that World War I was just the beginning of one big, long war.
Mm-hmm. It really was.
It's not necessarily over yet.
No, it's not necessarily over. But if you think about the days of change that went on during this time of transformation, I mean, World War I changed everything. Men were riding on horseback into battle, just the way they did during the Civil War. They rode into battle. By the end of the war, there were airplanes. Mm-hmm. They rode in to battle and flew out at the end of the war. Imagine that change taking place in such a short time.
In the articles in this magazine, the VFW magazine, they talk about the introduction of air power as one of the ways they felt that they could actually get some movement going in the war.
Yes.
I'm going to be talking later on with Dr. Sundhaus about, you know, some of the weaponry and so forth that was developed as a result. And, this was just, as you said, I think the idea of all of the changes that occurred during this really only a little over, from our standpoint, America's standpoint, a little over a year and a half, was just amazing. I mean, not only did all of these young men go to France, and of course we have all the songs that talk about that, you know, how do you keep them down on the farm? But you've also got the women's vote is coming along.
Women had been working for the vote, had been... for, 80 years by the time World War I comes around. But at this point, they were marching, they were protesting in front of the White House. President Wilson was calling them traitors, traitors, because they were, marching during a time of war. They said, no one should be criticizing the government during warfare. These women are traitors. And they were thrown into prison and treated abominably. At the same time, there were women, we're familiar with the story of Rosie the Riveter during World War II.
Right.
Well, our chairman, Rob D'Alessandro, likes to say, Rosie the Riveter had a mother, and that mother was working in the factories during World War I. We have forgotten all about that women were working in the munition factories. They were working in building, helping with ordnance and, all sorts of things for the war effort. And when the war ended, the announcement sort of came out that, well, women had worked hard enough during the war that they deserve the vote. And I think that gave congressmen the chance to change their mind. Men who had stood firmly against women voting were able to say, well, because of the war, now we'll let women vote because of their work during the war effort. But certainly American women were just ready to put their heart and souls into it the way their brothers and their husbands and their sons were doing it for World War One.
It is fascinating, not only with the women here at home, but there were also, I know there were a lot of women in the Red Cross that went to France.
This was all new. The women would be in uniform. I mean, there were women who were enlisted by the Navy, by the Army, and by the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
That had never happened. There are always women who are with the military. Okay, women go along.
Mm-hmm.
There are women who are doing the laundry. There are women who are being nurses. There are women who are doing all sorts of things. But World War I is the first time they're formally enlisted on a large scale, and they're wearing uniforms. And they're in uniform for the Red Cross as well. And that makes them more professional. Do you see the difference? You can volunteer and just be in your clothes and maybe wear a pin saying I'm with them. But here they are now in uniform being paid. It makes a big difference.
It does. And that's a whole other story. I'd love to have you back on and talk more about that, because we know that many times they didn't necessarily get the benefits they were entitled to.
You're absolutely right.
They didn't get the medals they were entitled to.
They were in the line of fire, not intentionally often, but the hospitals were shelled. These were dangerous places. They were up in those field hospitals, and it took a long time for them to get pensions. It's a sad story.
It is, but we're going to make it a positive story. We're going to make this whole thing about World War One a very positive story. We've been talking with Dr. Livy O'Connell from the United States World War One Centennial Commission. Their website, and all of you need to go to this website, it's got an amazing amount of information on here. It's World War One, spelled out World War, the number one, centennial.org, and you can find out all about what's coming up. You can also make donations on this. You can find out who to communicate with. There's articles. There's all kinds of things on here, and I think it's a great opportunity for all of us to get involved in helping people not to forget this war to end all wars that is still going on. And I want to thank you so very much for being on our program, Dr. O'Connell, and I can't wait to talk to you again about more, find out more about this. We'd love to help you more.
Obviously, I could talk for too long a time. So call me again. I'd love to talk to you. And World War One is fascinating. It's complicated, but it's got such great stories. And I'm so glad that you were interested. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It was my pleasure, and we'll talk to you again. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye, Dale.
All right. Bye. All right, we're coming up on a break. When we come off around on the other side, we're going to have another one on. Dr. Lawrence Sondhaus, who is a professor of history and specializes in World War One, is going to be on after the news. So I suggest you tune in. Remember to follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, listen to our archives, go to our bookstore. Send us your stories. We need you around. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Get your gun. Take it on the run. Hear them calling you and me, everyone for liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, start today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud our boys in love.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The Yanks are coming, and we are talking more and more about World War One, and we're going to continue with that with our next guest, who is Dr. Lawrence Sondhaus. And Dr. Sondhaus is a professor of history at the University of Indianapolis, where he is director of the Institute for the Study of War and Diplomacy. He has written many books, which we're probably going to talk about World War One. One of the ones that I started reading was just World War One, but he's got one coming out about submarines and boats and all kinds of things. So I'm very excited to have Dr. Sondhaus on the program. So, Dr. Sondhaus, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'd like to start off maybe by echoing what your previous speaker said at the end, that World War One is complicated, fascinating, and full of great stories. And I would agree with her. That's really what has attracted me to this war, as opposed to others that your listeners may know more about.
I think that's what's really important, and why I wanted to have you on the program today. As we were talking in the first half, we mentioned that the VFW magazine that came out this month is all about World War One, and it's got great stories in there. It's got about famous people that were in World War One, such as President Harry Truman and Christy Mathewson, and all kinds of things that I thought was kind of interesting to me. And then, of course, you're talking about the weaponry. You have an article in here that talks about the weaponry and so on. So I think it looks like, you know, maybe we can get this ball rolling to let people become more and more aware of World War One and really what led up to it and what were the results of it. Because that, to me, is really what I found most fascinating.
Sure. So I don't know what direction you'd like to go in. I could go in a lot of different directions.
All right. Well, let's start off with how it began in 1914. What were all of the gears that suddenly came hooked up at the same time there?
Well, this is where it's sort of the murky beginning to go with the murky ending. In the book you referred to, my World War I, The Global Revolution, came out about 5-6 years ago. I argue that it's a little bit unconventional, but I argue that that the responsibility for starting the war lies with Serbia, and the responsibility for escalating it once it the ball got rolling goes with the Germans. That we forget often that the Archduke and his wife, who were shot at Sarajevo, the heir to the Austrian throne, and his wife, really were the first casualties of the war. And the 19-year-old student Gavrilo Princip, the Bosnian Serb who assassinated them, was a member of a terrorist group, and there was literally a smoking gun. The firearm used in the assassination was issued by the Serbian army, and he had been a part of a group armed and trained by kind of a rogue group of Serbian army officers. They had a territorial dispute with Austria-Hungary. Of course, Austria-Hungary was a much greater and stronger country than Serbia, had Germany standing behind it as a staunch ally, but the Serbs had Russia standing behind them. So one of the things, of course, after the war that gets a lot of the blame for the way the Archduke's assassination leads to a world war is that you had standing alliances and standing commitments that countries had to each other, in some cases going back to decades before the war started. So when Austria gets into a dispute with Serbia, the Germans jump in behind the Austrians, the Russians jump in behind the Serbs, then the French support the Russians, and so on and so forth, until most of Europe was sucked into war within a matter of weeks.
But the Russians got out pretty quickly, didn't they?
They're the first ones to the first ones to be knocked out, because of course everybody, the saying the boys will be home by Christmas really comes from World War One, because everybody assumed it would be a short war. Often we see the myth repeated that that the generals didn't understand what modern war was going to be like, and they didn't understand that you couldn't launch frontal assaults into machine gun fire, and you had the trenches and the barbed wire and so forth. Well, most of these features were already known, because there had been a big war in the Far East between Russia and Japan 10 years earlier, and both sides had hosted military observers from the other armies. So most of the armies of Europe had witnessed firsthand what trench warfare, frontal assaults, and machine gun fire and all of this looked like. There were other things, of course, that come about in the Second World War, aircraft, poison gas, and so forth. But they all knew what the battlefield would look like. What they didn't expect was that it would go on for as long as it did. They knew that they would have about 35% casualties, but they didn't understand what that would mean if you did the math beyond just a few months and extrapolated that out into 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And, of course, one thing that was a crisis, even in Germany, the best-prepared country, before Christmas of 1914, they almost ran out of artillery shells. There was a crisis of war production in all countries, because they had done a mathematical calculation based on that war 10 years earlier of how many shells you needed per gun, and by Thanksgiving, most countries were running short of shells by November, December or so. It really was a crisis, and war production was a big part of this. And as your previous guest commented, you know, women came in to fill the breach in the factories as more and more able-bodied men are drawn into the service. But I think the one critical thing there was that not so much that they didn't know what to expect going into the war, but nobody calculated that it would go on for beyond just a few months.
So was it in America? What was going on in America in 1914? How did we get? I mean, I know how we got dragged into it eventually, but there wasn't that issue at that point, was it? That we were just kind of we were were we isolationists at that point?
Yes, the United States was really, because beyond Europe, the Japanese had an alliance with the British, which pulls them into the war in the Pacific. But the United States, among the eight most significant powers on Earth as of 1914, the six major European powers plus the Japanese and the Americans, we were the only ones that did not have an alliance with somebody.
Okay.
So we were truly neutral in every sense of the word, but we very quickly developed a stake in an Allied victory because the British put a pretty effective blockade on the Germans as soon as the war started, which meant that while in theory the U.S. insisted on its right as a neutral power to trade with either side, the reality was we were only trading with the Allies because we couldn't trade with the Germans because there was a British blockade.
There wasn't any way to get in there, right?
Yeah, so and from the beginning there's a kind of a hypocrisy of the American position because and a lot of dissent really within the Wilson administration, because his own Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, who had been a major figure in the Democratic Party, had actually been the nominee in three out of the previous four elections before Wilson, and it was 0-for-3 in trying to get elected to the White House. But Wilson did something very shrewd, kind of like Barack Obama making Hillary Clinton his Secretary of State, in order to honor but also include on his team someone within his party who would otherwise have been a major rival. He made William Jennings Bryan his Secretary of State. And Bryan had pacifist convictions. He did not believe the U.S. should be involved in the war. And he was critical from the beginning of Wilson for tilting towards the Allies. He believed that while German submarine warfare and the sinking of ships killing civilians on the high seas was a terrible thing, that the British blockade of Germany, of course, was also illegal under international law because they weren't allowing anything in. They weren't allowing food in. They weren't allowing medicine in. They weren't allowing anything in. As much as the U.S. protested German actions on the high seas, the U.S. did not, in the views of the Secretary of State, Bryan, did not sort of even-handedly then also equally criticize the British blockade. So, of course, that blockade was just as much of an impingement of freedom of the seas as any German commerce raiding where American citizens might be killed aboard a British ship, as was the case in the Lusitania in 1915. So actually, in the wake of that Lusitania sinking, Bryan ended up having a falling out with Wilson, resigned from the cabinet, and Lansing, his that was a pretty fateful turn of events, because Lansing, his successor as Secretary of State, became the strongest voice within the cabinet for intervening on the side of the Allies.
Oh, okay.
So from that point onward, the U.S. continued to move closer and closer to the position of intervening. But during this time, of course, the U.S. economy, even before the U.S. got involved in the war, the U.S. economy was booming as a result of our role, even before we were an ally of the Allies, of selling them munitions.
Oh, so we were another source of income 100 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So our economy during the teens was very successful, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, there were, I give some figures, and not to try to recite figures over the year here, but I give figures in my book there where the amount of American exports went up, amount of American manufactured goods going out went up, and a big chunk of that were the weapons that we were providing to the Allies. And then as time went on, and the Allies, all countries really become, the war is a stalemate, and there's no end in sight. It's all very expensive, and they pretty much tap out the resources of their own people, selling war bonds, getting people to buy war bonds, and so forth. They're looking for capital internationally, and you have this interesting turn of events where the British, the Americans, the other allies all start selling war bonds on the New York market. And the U.S. then ends up becoming a major creditor of the allies. We're, in effect, loaning them money through all of the war bonds that they're selling, British bonds, French bonds, that American investors and banks and so forth are snapping up. So we end up with this situation, of course, by the time the war is over, that the U.S. goes from being, in 1914, the world's leading debtor, a place where the British and other more developed countries came to invest money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the railroads that were built across the Rocky Mountains, and even cattle ranches, factories, all kinds of business enterprises in the United States had been funded in the 1800s by British investors. We were a developing country, you know, kind of like a Brazil or a Mexico or a, today, a country that was soaking up investment capital from other countries. But, of course, that made us, on the balance sheet, the world's largest debtor, because we had all of these other countries investing in our economy. And then here, within just the span of 4 or 5 years, by 1918, 1919, we're the world's biggest creditor. The financial center of the world has moved from London to New York. And now even the British, the strongest and greatest of the industrial powers, are coming to us hat in hand to borrow money.
Oh, okay. I'm going to have you pause right there.
Sure.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about all of the other alliances, like the Ottoman Empire and so on and so forth, and how the American soldier actually got involved in the war. So hold on, hold those thoughts. And we'll be right back in just a minute. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
I dreamed of a scene in an old soldier's home. The year was 1953. With medals galore that he'd won in this war, he sat smoking peacefully. Tell me of the war of 1917, said his grandson who stood by his side. How did they fix up that terrible mix-up? And proudly the old man replied, the Russians were rushing the Prussians. The Prussians were crushing the Russians. The Balkans were balking, and Turkey was squawking, Rasputin disputing, and Italy hooting. The vultures all bulldozed the key. The British were watching the sea. But the good Lord, I'm thanking, the Yanks started yanking, and Yank Kaiser filled up a tree.
And we're back on Veterans Radio with some of that fine music from 1917 or 18. It was hard finding the band to play it like that, but we did. Anyway, I thought that was kind of appropriate. We're talking right now with Dr. Lawrence Sondhaus, a history professor at the University of Indianapolis and an expert on World War I, about all of the entanglements of all of the different countries that were involved in World War I. And as that song pointed out, you know, the Russians and the Prussians and the thises and the thatins and Turkey is squawking and so forth. Where did the Ottoman Empire come into this mixture?
Well, they were kind of on the fence when the war started. And they actually had sought the best advice to train their own armed forces. So they had British naval advisors and German military advisors. And the Turkish Sultan decided ultimately, pushed by some of his advisors, to opt for the Germans. And they ended up then being a pretty important factor, because they controlled the Dardanelles and the Bosporus, the straits between the Mediterranean and the Black Sea, and were able to defend those straits against British and British Empire landings, the Australians and New Zealanders, for example. Their big baptism of fire in the war was at Gallipoli, in this failed attempt to force their way through there. And when the Turks held, ultimately that had tremendous consequences for Russia, because the way through the Mediterranean and the Black Sea would have been the easiest way to put a supply route through to Russia. Of course, Russia, the Russia of World War I, was the old Imperial Russia, which was the most backward of the great powers in terms of its industry and so forth. So even though the Russians could put a lot of people out into the field, they had a hard time equipping them. And so they were desperately in need of help from their allies and ended up not getting much in terms of war material. So the Turkish presence in the war on the side of the Germans really was critical in World War I.
So just for our audience's sake, could you describe the Ottoman Empire was mostly what we would consider the Middle East now?
Yes. Yes, okay. Where you had Turks ruling over. By this time, it had been whittled down to where a lot of its former territories were gone. But you pretty much had Turks ruling over Arabs in much of the Middle East. And one feature of the war was, of course, an Arab revolt against the Turks, in which the key figure was Lawrence of Arabia, a British Army colonel, Colonel Lawrence, who was actually a scholar. He was he had been in the Middle East doing archaeological research and so forth before the war. He knew the languages. He knew the terrain and the topography. He understood the culture of the Arabs. So, as an intelligence officer, he was sent out to the desert to basically stir up the Arabs against the Turks, and succeeded in doing so. And some of your listeners may be familiar with the 1962 Peter O'Toole four-hour film of this, which is, you know, it, obviously there's a lot of creative license in that film, but it's, you know, generally accurate in terms of depicting how events unfolded, or giving a reasonable facsimile for a historical film of how things unfolded. And of course, we end up having some of the roots of the modern-day Arab-Israeli crisis in World War I, because the British led the Arabs to believe that they were going to get Jerusalem and Palestine when the war was over. But at the same time, Lord Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, had promised the Zionists the right to establish Jewish settlements in Palestine. That was also made during the war. So the British basically committed themselves to allowing Arabs to have control over Palestine, but to allow Jews to settle there in the event that Britain ended up in possession of Palestine when the war was over. As luck would have it, Britain ended up in possession of Palestine when the war was over, and the two sides both then started on their, at least the modern-day iteration of that rivalry.
Okay, I can see we're going to run out of time already.
Sure.
Haven't even gotten to the war.
Yeah.
I want to ask you back on. We've got about 5 minutes, so I want to make sure. I did have one other question. Let's do our lead up to the war. Were the American forces, was that voluntary? Were they volunteers, or was there a draft for the World War One?
There was a draft, and this was the first time since the Union Army in World War, in the Civil War, briefly attempted a draft. So there was a draft. We end up with 4.2 million men mobilized, of whom about 2.1 million actually make it over to France before the armistice. And out of that 2.1 million, about two-thirds, about 1.4 million, were actually on the front lines when the war ended. And so on a day-by-day-by-day basis, from the summer of 1918 on into the fall, the American share of the fighting was growing on a day-by-day basis, to the point of where at the time of the armistice, there were many, many more Americans at the front than there were Frenchmen. And also, the number of Americans around the 1st of November had just surpassed the total number of British and British Empire troops, too.
Wow.
If the war had continued into 1919, of course, the American share would have been even bigger. Woodrow Wilson was probably the ideal president for civil-military relations from the military point of view, because he told Blackjack Pershing, "I don't care how you win the war, I just want to be in the driver's seat at the peace conference more."
Right, and we'll talk about that when we have you on again, because we know that peace conference didn't necessarily go the way that Wilson wanted it.
No, it didn't, but he certainly was put in a position of strength there, and it was mainly because Pershing had delivered on his charge to make sure that by the time the war was over, there would be a clear and unmistakable American contribution to the victory, and that there was.
Okay, and meanwhile, the Russians had had to kind of back out because they had their own revolution going on.
Which made it all the more critical for the United States mm-hmm. to arrive to save the day, essentially on the Western Front, in sufficient number, in sufficient numbers in time, which they did. The Germans, a lot of people don't know this, but the Germans in the summer of 1918 got as close to Paris, or closer to Paris than they had been at any time since their initial attack in the summer of 1914. And if American troops had not arrived in force in time, the Germans could have made it to Paris, and history would have unfolded very differently.
I got a feeling it might have. So, was there an Eastern Front, as Hitler tried in World War II?
Oh, absolutely. There was a major Eastern Front, and that's a whole other story.
All right. Yes. Well, we've got a lot of things.
There was a major Eastern Front that we don't hear about a whole lot in the American and British, the English language literature. But yes, there was a major Eastern Front throughout the war.
All right. Well, as I said, we're coming up on the top of the hour. So we've been talking with Dr. Lawrence Sondhaus. I encourage you to go to our website on Veterans Radio, and you can order his book on there, the one about World War One. And you've got other books come out. I'll give you 20 seconds to give a plug on what's coming out next.
Well, I have a book on German submarine warfare coming out later this year with Roman and Littlefield Publishers. And I also have a book that came out just a couple of years ago called The Great War at Sea, A Naval History of World War One, with Cambridge University Press. And you can, I don't know if I can say Amazon on the air, but you can look me up
no.
on
well,
Amazon.
We're an affiliate of Amazon, so we understand
okay.
that. All right.
So, yeah, you can find my books on Amazon or other vendors.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Sondhaus. I can't wait to talk to you again. And best of luck, and we'll be talking.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, we're coming down to the end. Holy mackerel, 30 seconds to go. Well, we'll be back next week. We're going to be talking about Iraq and Afghanistan next week with an American political appointee who was working as a worker in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that's coming up next week. In the meantime, we know all about World War One now, so we'll make sure that you go to our website. You'll find out more information as we go. Until next week, you are dismissed.